Thank you for downloading this podcast from the UK Intensive Care Society State of the Art Meeting 2015. It's even better in person, so put December the 5th to the 7th, 2016 in your diary and come and join us in London next year.
That where he is today, and we're delighted that he's come to talk with us this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Can you hear me all right? That was a great introduction from John. One of the things that I've done since I joined the CQC 2 years ago is visit an enormous number of hospitals and an enormous number of intensive care units across England. And I have to say, I've been largely very impressed by what I've found, and I was particularly impressed by what I saw in Portsmouth. As I'll say at the end of this presentation, critical care, intensive care, is leading the way in the services we inspect in terms of the quality of care we're demonstrating. And I think there is an awful lot that you can take pride in terms of delivering a really first-class critical care service in England. Let me tell you, I've been asked to talk about hospitals and critical care and what we've found. That's an awfully big topic, so I shall rush through quickly some of what we found in hospitals, which you may well have heard of already, just emphasising some of the points that perhaps don't get emphasised really enough as we talk about the findings of CQC inspections. First of all, remember the background. I joined the CQC 2 years ago from my job in Oxford, and the reason I joined the CQC was I was shocked by what came out of the Francis report, and I felt, really, we've got to do something about that, and joining the CQC was my opportunity to do that. And you remember that Francis and the later Morecambe Bay report, which came out this year, talk about what the problem in the NHS being one of culture and leadership. Culture and leadership. And I suppose what we're trying to do more than anything with our CQC inspection programme, which started in September 2013 and will finish in March of next year, is to identify any potential failures and deal with them before they fail, so we don't get another crisis in the NHS like this. But fundamentally, it is about changing the culture and challenging the leadership of the NHS to do better. And that is what our inspections and our reports are intended to do. So what are we doing different in these inspections? And some of you may well have been on our inspections as SPAs, and thank you if you have. We have larger teams of 35 for an average-sized hospital, a lot more for a very big or multi-site hospital. And those teams are made up of about 50% of CQC inspectors, specialist CQC inspectors. So the CQC inspector who leads the team inspecting your critical care has often inspected many other critical cares before. And so they come with a lot of expertise of their own, but they're accompanied by serving clinicians from other hospitals to give them advice about the quality of care, to give them advice about the standards, but also to give them some insight into what they're seeing, to allow for that variation and to allow for the recognition of good practice. We have a very clear framework we inspect around. We ask 5 key questions. I'll come to those in a moment. And those questions are supported by what we call key lines of inquiry. And that forms a framework to make sure we're consistent in what we look at in every inspection we do. There is a strong focus on talking to staff, and that includes senior staff across the organisation, but also frontline junior staff, and of course also patients, and in critical care, carers and families of patients as well. What we hear from frontline staff, what we hear from patients, often is very different from what we're told by the board of the trust we talk to. And so what we're trying to do is make that connection. Does the organisation really know what's going on in its front line? Is it really listening to the voices of staff and patients? And of course we rate, and I'll come to the ratings in a moment, but this is about cultural change. So what we're not trying to do is find people to blame when we find problems. And a lot of the publicity around our reports focuses on who is to blame. And we always try and steer away from that. And if you look at our reports, they don't blame anyone. They just say there are problems, and this is the challenge for the leadership to deal with them. What we're trying to do is create a culture of transparency and honesty about the problems in healthcare so that quality improvement can take place. And the end of every inspection is a quality summit where we bring everyone from that organisation, to all the key people from the organisation and the commissioners together to drive forward the quality improvement process going forward after the inspection. So the team is made up of a chair, And as I say, doctors, nurses, allied health professionals, therapists, some health service managers, what we call experts by experience, which are patients or carers, and analysts. And as I say, about 35 for a DGH, but a lot more for a bigger trust. And these are the key lines of inquiry. I can't go through them all, there are too many to go through, but each one comes under a key question. The first key question we ask of any service is it safe? And by that we mean, are people protected from abuse and avoidable harm? And then there's a series of key lines of inquiry. The first two here, what is the track record on safety? Are lessons learned and improvements made when things go wrong? And there's a whole series of key lines of inquiry under safety, dealing with things like risk assessment, dealing with the quality of the processes to manage safety, dealing with the anticipation of risk and mitigating it. And then the second question we ask is, are the services effective? And that is about, are they based on evidence-based guidelines? This is the first key line of inquiry here. But also, what are outcomes? And as John said a few minutes ago, in critical care, there is a very strong outcome-based culture. And that has been very helpful in our assessments of critical care. We also ask whether staff have the right skills and knowledge to undertake the work they're doing. We look at teamwork and how the different disciplines work together effectively. We look at the information and records, and we also ask under effectiveness about consent, and that includes Mental Capacity Act and deprivation of liberty safeguards. So effectiveness covers a wide area beyond just outcomes, although outcomes are very important. And then we ask the third question, are the services caring? And by caring, we mean the one-to-one interaction between members of staff and patients or the patient's relatives and carers. So it's that interplay between individuals. And how does that work? Are patients treated with dignity and respect? Are their emotional needs met? Is there involvement of patients and families in decisions about patients' care? Those are the kind of questions we ask under caring. And then responsive, and that is the patient experience in terms of how the organisation organises services around their care. So it's about timeliness of services. Are they planned? Do they occur timeliness in a timely way? How does the organisation manage feedback? And how does it meet the needs of different patients under different circumstances? And then finally, and this is really very important, we look at leadership. Is the service well led? And we look not just at leadership at the top of the organisation, we look at leadership at every level in the organisation, from the board right down to leadership at ward and clinical team level. And we often find marked variations in the quality of leadership in a single organisation. And here we ask staff about the culture. What's it like to work here? Do you feel able to raise concerns? Do you feel supported? And we ask about continuous improvement, and John has given us some brilliant examples of how leadership is driving that in his ICU. So when we look at an acute hospital, we look at 8 core services, of which critical care is one. But of course, all the ordinary ones you'd expect, A&E, medical care, surgery, maternity, services for children and young people, end-of-life care and outpatients. And in some big hospitals, we will look at other services as well if they make a large part of the service provided. But in all acute trusts, these are the core services we look at. And each core service has a framework, and the framework is built up on the key lines of inquiry I've already described to you. This is our core service framework for critical care. And it talks here on the first page, the areas to inspect. And you'll see we look at intensive care, we also look at high dependency units and level 2 care in the institution. We don't take account of who manages what. So it might be the ICU doesn't run that HDU. It's still, from our purposes, part of the critical care service of that trust. And so one of the things we often found is that the ICU team has little input into an HDU, which is perhaps run by a surgical team or a medical team. But we look at the quality of care across the board, and often the problems we find in critical care are in those isolated HDUs rather than in the ICU. And this is some of the work we do in terms of talking to people. We talk to the clinical director, we talk to the nursing lead, the director, the divisional manager, and then we talk to staff and relatives. We talk to PALs and find out about complaints about the ICU and the critical care and how they're dealt with. We will also look and talk to any critical care outreach team or any equivalent service in that institution, because I know that not all hospitals have what they call a critical care outreach team. But we will ask, how is that function? How is the deteriorating patient on the inpatient wards managed safely? And then this comes back to the specifics for critical care. And here we've taken the prompts I've shown you a few minutes ago under safety. And then we've taken some professional standards. We drew these up with support of the Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine. And then the detail of the evidence we look at in each critical care unit. Now, this is all available on the web if you want to see what we look at. This is all publicly available documentation, and you can see the detail we go into in every inspection that takes place. And then we rate, and the rating is based upon what we've observed on site and what we've seen. It's also based on monitoring data we've got for the trust and information the trust has provided. And we rate each core service against each of the key questions. And then we aggregate the ratings up for the site, the hospital site as a whole, and if there's more than one site in the trust, and then eventually for the trust as a whole. So the rating is an aggregation up process. And this is a typical grid from a typical single site hospital we'll come up with. And you see on the left there, the eight core services. And you see across the top, the five key questions. And so there are 40 ratings, one for each, 39, because we don't rate outpatients, for one rating for each core service for each key question. And so for A&E, we ask, is it good? Give it a rating. Is it effective? Give it a rating. Caring, a rating. Responsive, a rating. Good, a rating. And so on. And then we give a rating overall for that key service. So you see critical care in this particular example comes out as good across the board. And to be good is not to be perfect. It is to be a good standard as supported by the specialist advisors we've got, without significant matters in terms of quality or safety that need to be improved. And you'll see here there's one element of outstanding in caring and end-of-life care, and this aggregates up for this trust to good overall. Compare this, if you will, to the next example, another trust, another single site, where we found a lot of areas, particularly under responsive safety and well-led, that require improvement. And you see there's one area in maternity where safety was deemed to be inadequate. We saw urgent safety improvements were necessary. That's what inadequate means. Urgent safety improvements are necessary. An inadequate rating will often be accompanied by the CQC taking regulatory action and instructing the organisation to take improvements. You see, overall, because this organisation is not consistent, they come out as requires improvement. There's a lot of good there, and there is some outstanding, but they have to be consistent across all core services to come out as good. And this is an example of an organisation that came out as inadequate overall, and you see the key areas that often let organisations down are the acute pathway. Here, A&E and surgery, but often medicine as well. So that acute pathway that is under enormous pressure in trusts is often not running well and has major safety or quality concerns and leads to inadequate ratings. And if you've got inadequate ratings to that degree, you come out as inadequate overall. And we always look at well-led at trust level and decide whether that is needs a separate rating. And in this case, we've judged it as inadequate. So the trust has come out inadequate. And compare that to this organisation that came out as overall outstanding. And you'll see that they have a lot of good, a significant amount of outstanding, particularly around leadership, responsive and caring, but they still have one area that requires improvement, safety for children. And that is often the way, in every organisation we go to, there is variability in the ratings we find. So we've rated the majority of acute trusts now. As I say, we've got about 3 months to go before we get to number 153, I think it is, and we've finished them all. And you'll see on the left here a measure of the ratings we've got in the trusts we've rated so far. And you'll see they vary between a trust at the top with blue and green to one at the bottom with significant red and amber in it. But having said that, there is good in virtually every trust, and there is requires improvement in every trust. And one of the things that we've found is, yes, there's a big variation in quality between hospitals, but in many hospitals there's big variation of quality within the hospital. And we'll often find services next to each other, sometimes even wards next to each other, with marked variation in quality. I've lost my slides. Thank you. So one of the things that we find in hospitals, and this is a real concern, is that hospitals seem to feel they're in a constant crisis. They're managing every day as though it's a new crisis. There's little long-term planning. And so the workload that comes into hospitals clearly is unpredictable day to day, but over long term it can be predicted and planned for. And yet we often find hospitals are not expecting it, and they say they're having the busiest day ever. And it's amazing, whenever we go to see a hospital, they always tell us they're having their busiest day ever. It must be some effect we have on hospitals, I don't know. The A&E departments are the area under the greatest strain, and that is the area where we see the most day-to-day crisis management. And this is a real concern to us, the number of problems we see in A&E departments. Staffing is a major concern across organisations, as I'm sure you know. And the safety culture is key. The safety culture is key. Every place we go tells us safety is their first concern. It's our top priority. Everyone says that to us. But actually, what we see in reality, in the wards, in the clinical areas, is very variable. And we see very strong safety cultures, and John's described one in Portsmouth. We also see very weak safety cultures, where basic checks are just not being done. Basic checks of equipment, of training, of medicines, out-of-date medicines, out-of-date equipment, is just still there, sitting, waiting to be used on patients. So basic safety checks being done day in, day out, a culture that puts safety absolutely at the top of the list, is something we don't see often enough by any stretch of the imagination. There is also an awful lot of variation still in terms of clinical governance, clinical risk management and quality assurance. Sometimes it is done well, often there is tokenism. There are clinical governance meetings, we ask to see the minutes from the meetings, and they contain nothing of any relevance whatsoever. So clinical governance needs to be taken seriously. And one of the things to note, not particularly relevant today, is that our focus on outpatients has identified the chaos in many outpatient departments across the country, how badly they are managed. It is absolutely frightening to see the disorganisation of some outpatient departments. So the overall ratings for the trusts we've rated so far, 63%, nearly two-thirds, coming out requires improvement. A quarter are coming out as good, only 2% so far outstanding, and about 10% inadequate. Only 20% of the hospitals overall were judged to be good for safety. We haven't found a single trust we've judged to be outstanding for safety as yet, which is a disappointment this far into the process. Many, many trusts need to improve their leadership. And we're not talking just about the new chief executive, we're talking about leadership culture at all levels. And sometimes we find leadership problems at the board, but often we find leadership problems at clinical directorate level, sometimes at ward level. And it is about the leadership culture and what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. We see too many organisations where staff tell us the culture is one of blame and bullying. Too many organisations where staff tell us that and tell us they hate coming to work because of that. And really, leadership needs to tackle that, needs to tackle it head on. I think about, if you look at the National Staff Survey, I think about 23% of NHS staff across England say they feel bullied at work. 23%, that's nearly one in four. And that is a reflection across the whole country. It's worse in some organisations. One of the problems we do have is sometimes the leadership, the formal leadership, sometimes the informal leadership, the medical staff committee or the senior sisters, will tell us that they haven't got a problem. They don't believe what we say to them. There's that sense of denial and refusal to accept feedback. And I've always thought that the culture of a good organisation is one that is open to feedback, open to showing what's going on externally and asking people to give feedback. And yet, we find an awful lot of organisations who are very resistant to feedback. Those organisations that accept their problems and deal with them often make rapid improvements. And we've seen that in many instances. And so there is a sense of what we're trying to do in the NHS is create a culture where people face up to the problems. Sometimes the problems have lasted for many years and not been addressed. Let me focus on critical care particularly. And this is the good news. Two-thirds of critical care units are either good or outstanding on our rating. Two-thirds. That's an incredibly good record. 29% requires improvement and only 4% inadequate. So critical care comes out really top of all the eight core services we look at. Here, we look at the safety question. What are the ratings for safety? And you'll see that 60% of critical care units come out as good or outstanding for safety. And for effective, it's 82% come out as good or outstanding for effective. And this comes back to the outcome-based culture that we're hearing about earlier on. And you see that is better than virtually any of the ones. We don't rate outpatients, which is why it's coming out as 100% green. That's just a quirk of the statistics. But critical care is coming out the best there. And in terms of caring, we haven't found a single critical care service we've rated as less than good across England so far. 100% either good or outstanding. 7% outstanding, which is incredible. Responsive is not quite as good. It's 60% good or outstanding. And the biggest issue we have in terms of responsiveness is sometimes the timeliness of patients being admitted, although that's less often the problem. It's more the delays in patients being discharged from ICU and sometimes the discharge out of hours. And that is often the responsiveness. And of course, what we hear from the ICU is that's the hospital's fault because they won't make the beds available for us. I have to say, we don't like the it's someone else's fault response. We would much prefer if the ICU got involved somehow in helping the hospital solve the problem. Well led. Well led comes out as 70% good or outstanding for critical care. So we've seen some exceptional leadership in critical care. We have seen some poor leadership, so 4% inadequate, but it is very much a minority. So again, critical care is coming out the best. So when you look at the concerns we've found in critical care services, we have found areas where medical or nursing staffing does not meet the expected standards, either in terms of staffing having the right skills and competencies or in terms of numbers. That is more often in high dependency units than intensive care units, I should say. We've seen some high dependency units and intensive care units where the physical space really is not up to the job. And in some of those instances where we've produced a report, the trust has gone out and immediately made a capital investment. So we've been, I think, helpful in that regard. But there is no doubt some of you are working in an environment that is less than satisfactory. Sometimes in big hospitals, and this is particularly teaching hospitals, you find there's more than one critical care unit. And sometimes you find two different cultures, two different standards, two different leaderships in the different critical care units. Well, we look at it as one. So it may be that the cardiac critical care unit or the neurosurgical critical care unit down the road is nothing to do with you, but it will be part of our assessment of critical care at that hospital. And really what we would challenge you to do is actually how in a big hospital do you make sure you've got consistency of leadership of critical care. I mentioned discharge to the outpatient wards. I've mentioned outcomes being incredibly important in this regard. We've found some variability in critical care outreach teams. And as I say, it's high dependency units rather than ICU where the problem. The leadership problems I mentioned there are really unusual, but they are still there, and sometimes they have been problems for many years, and sometimes we've seen leadership that's been in place for many years has been a problem and has not been addressed. But the positive, critical care services are scored most highly in all our inspections. We've rated more services outstanding than any other core service, and we've seen many exemplary examples of care. It's good or consistently, it's good or outstanding consistently for caring. And we've seen more examples of outstanding ratings for safety, effectiveness, and well-led than any other services. One of the things that makes critical care such a delight to inspect is that you have, in many ways, good leadership, good standards, very clear standards, and great measures of outcome, which most of you contribute to, and by the time we've been round, I hope all of you will be contributing to. We've seen many examples of critical care units doing a great job, and I hope we've contributed some quality improvements from our inspection programme. Thank you very much.